We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
Have you ever listened to the pod and thought it would be awesome if Jen stopped being nerdy about movies for 60 seconds and talked about your business instead? Well, my friends, you're in luck. Watch with Jen is looking for sponsors. Do you own or run a theater, bookstore, film fest, website, school, physical media firm, pod, streaming channel, or small business that might like to advertise on Watch with Jen? Whether you're interested in sponsoring one episode or several, please reach out. You can get a hold of me at contact@filmintuition.com. Thanks so much. Hey, this is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. Well, joining me today, I am so pleased to welcome one of the hosts of Screen Drafts, Clay Keller, who is a fellow Minnesotan and a brilliant cinephile. We have a lot of similar tastes, and I've been looking forward to this. So, Clay, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, before we got on, you were asking me if I have a preferred introduction, and I should have just said Minnesotan is how I should be introduced.
Yes, absolutely.
Enthusiastic Minnesotan.
When did you move out to LA?
Well, that's the thing. I'm coming up now on actually having lived in Southern California longer than I lived in Minnesota.
I know.
Which I will feel guilty about.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, it happened for me a couple years ago here in Phoenix. And I was like, oh, man, what is that?
Yeah,
still identify as Minnesotan.
Well, and I think anybody who just heard you say, oh, man, probably knows that you're a Minnesotan as well.
Yes.
It sticks with you. No, I came out to SoCal in 2006 for school. Okay. So it's been, but that was Orange County. So I've only been in LA for 14 years now. So not quite half and half, but
gotcha.
Getting there.
Yeah, getting there for sure. Yeah, I think I slide into the accent when I know I'm talking to fellow Midwestern residents or people who are from there, like my friend Rob Belushi from Chicago. We kind of go into that. So, You know, I'm sure by the end of this, everyone will be like, why does it sound like Fargo all of a sudden on the show? But
I remember when Fargo came out and I feel like a lot of Minnesotans were sort of offended and defensive and like, well, that's not how we all sound. And I'm kind of like, that is a little, it's not.
Yeah, it's a caricature.
It's not that far off.
Yes.
It's kind of fair.
Yes, exactly. You know, we should ask before we jump in, good Minnesota accents you've heard on film. I think one I really liked was Marissa Tomei in Untamed Heart. It's gentle, but it sounds like us.
Interesting. Good Minnesotan accents on film. I guess, yeah, Marissa Tomei is good in Untamed Heart. Mm-hmm. Untamed Heart is funny because she's the only person attempting a Minnesota accent.
Yes.
Everybody else
is just doing whatever. Rosie Perez, whatever.
Yeah, there's Rosie Perez is the least Minnesotan person playing a Minnesotan Minneapolis citizen has ever been in a film. I've really not thought about it that much. They're not usually that. I mean, I feel like they often tend maybe more in a Chicago-y
yes
vein. But the best Minnesotan movies, Fargo aside, are really not, they don't lean into the Minnesota-ness of
no they don't
at all. Like Young Adult doesn't really lean into the Minnesota-ness.
Yeah.
There's like a little bit in Juno, but yeah, Prairie Home Companion even doesn't, or
Simple Plan doesn't.
Simple Plan doesn't. A Serious Man doesn't. So it's interesting. But honestly, yeah. Like I said, I think the Fargo accents are pretty good. And actually in the show Fargo, there have been a few people who really nail it.
Yeah.
In the most recent season, I thought, the Irish actress from Wild Rose.
Jesse Buckley.
Yeah, Buckley did a really good one in the most recent season of Fargo. Yeah.
As a singer, she can really adapt her pitch to and her rhythms to whatever accent she's doing. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. She was great. Yeah, we're doing it. Yeah,
I know. We're gonna drive everyone nuts, but we're not even here to talk about Minnesota stuff. But we had to. Another thing Clay and I have in common before we jump in is we both worked at Mann Theaters back in Minnesota. I was at Maple Grove. Where were you again?
I was at the Plymouth 12.
Okay.
So way out by Wayzata High School was where I was just on the edge of the, it's so funny living in LA, you drive for an hour and a half and you never leave the city.
Yes.
And then you go back to the suburbs. I don't know where I grew up in kind of the Minnetonka Hopkins line.
I was in Champlin, Anoka, that area.
Okay. So you're even a little further out. Yeah. You can drive, 14 minutes and be.
Yes.
Be in the country. But yeah, so I worked at the Plymouth 12, which was kind of out there on the outskirts for on and off for 5 years, all through high school and then summers back from college. So the mid to late aughts was when I was there.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm older than Clay. So I worked like the biggest movie. I did it one summer. That was enough for me. But I worked Independence Day opening when that opened, and it was just insane. Yes.
That would have been insane. I think the most insane one I worked. Well, my first day of work was the opening night of Mean Girls.
Oh, wow.
And I think The Notebook was also playing. And there was something else, and it was a packed. My first night was a Friday night, and it was completely packed. It's very stressful. But yeah, you just don't get this anymore, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Just because the box, people don't go to the movies as much in general. But back in the day when there was no assigned seating.
No.
And really no online ticketing yet. I mean, you certainly would not have had online ticketing.
No, not at all.
We had, even by the time I stopped working at a movie theater in 2009, online ticketing, hardly anybody came in with printed out movieticketweb.com, whatever things. The energy was crazy for big movies on opening nights. I mean, the like lines around the block and all this, like that was a fairly common occurrence. But I remember we did the midnight opening of Pirates 3. We had this huge lobby and people were shoulder to shoulder, just crammed in waiting to get into that. And we kept adding shows. So there was like an 11:59, and then we added like a 12, 08, and then a 12 of this and a 12 of that. And we had to space them. They were all spaced out by 10 minutes because what we were doing was, I think we had two copies of it, two sets of reels. And projection booth was this big, long booth that ran through the middle, and there were screens on either side. There was 12 screens. So there was I think there was four on one side and eight on the other side. And they were running the reel directly out of one projector across the hallway into another projector. So if you went up into the booth, it was this crisscrossing web of celluloid running one
amazing.
Into the other so that we could run like eight screens of Pirates 3 on opening midnight.
I love that. That's a lost art. Yeah. People that
oh
know
my
how
God.
To
just the in and yeah. I'm sure it's something they had done before, but yeah, just the ingenuity. And I was never up in the I never worked. I was never a projectionist.
No,
but
me neither.
Just I can imagine just like it's coming, it's hitting the like tail end on the reel and you grab it and like run it across the hallway and spool it into the thing across the hall to start the next show. Just there was like a now there's probably no there's nobody in the projection booths now, right?
I don't think so. I think it's
just like servers playing DCPs. There used to be, there's an energy that's missing now from that. And I, you know, it was sometimes stressful working at the movie theater, but more often than not, it was downtime. I was like, I'm getting paid minimum wage, but also I stand around and play the like movie actor movie game with the other ushers, and I sneak popcorn and I watch, you know, eight minutes of various movies. I just stand in the back and watch movies over and over. So it's, you know, I thought it was a great high school job.
For sure. I worked concession, and that was like overwhelming.
I kinda hated like fast concession. Food.
Yeah, I would get it. Like little popcorn burns. And I remember, like, I think I still have a couple tiny ones. But yeah, because sometimes people would pour the kernels in and forget to put the cap on, and then they'd shoot all over. Yeah.
It's hot back in concessions.
Yeah.
I understand why you quit now. If I was in concessions all the time.
Though, I mean, that was, yeah.
The free movies I would take such advantage of that. Oh, God, I would see things that weren't even good or I didn't like more than once. I think I saw the Nicole Kidman Bewitched four times, I think.
I saw that on a date. That was interesting. But anyway, I actually think it's a fun movie, but it's not like on the par of other.
I remember liking it also, but it's kind of regarded as this abomination.
So I don't know. Yes. I love the line in the movie when Will Ferrell is asked, you know, he was an actor who was in the only movie never to sell any DVD copies. They're like, you know, what went wrong? I'm going to blame wardrobe. It's just the most like Will Ferrell line. Yeah, I'm going to blame wardrobe. So yeah, let's blame wardrobe. No, on Bewitched. Yeah. But yeah, well, the way we were talking about it, we make it sound like, you know, we were in Cinema Paradiso, basically. But I can imagine.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Better than Cinema Paradiso, because unless I'm misremembering, they didn't have an icy machine.
They did not. No.
Cinema Paradiso. No.
See, that would have been a better movie. No, I'm just kidding. But I love that movie. But we're talking now about like the golden age of going to the movies, the 40s, 50s, 60s. And when we were coming up with ideas, I love that you wanted to go for a classic actor. You brought up Robert Ryan and said he was someone you were just kind of recently starting to check out. So I'd love to hear more about what it was that drew you to Robert Ryan.
Yeah, well, yeah, we started talking about what to do for this conversation. And what I like about your show is that it is a little bit more, you know, on Screen Drafts we do classic Hollywood vintage topics,
sure,
you know, several a year, but we don't get as granular generally, and I like the kind of latitude that your show has in terms of topics to get to kind of pick something more niche or dig into something deeper, or pick, you know, quite frankly, someone like Robert Ryan, who's this spectacular occasional lead, but kind of known as this kind of great character actor from the Golden Age. You know, we would never do a Robert Ryan draft on Screen Drafts just because of the nature of what the show is. So I was kind of trying to think of something sort of in that vein, something that I thought was interesting. And honestly, I just used this as an opportunity, which a lot of people do on my show, to force themselves to do some homework, to set aside the time to dig into something and, you know, not have an excuse to kind of bail on the research. And I thought of Robert Ryan, I think, because when we were talking about it, I had just recently been to Minnesota, and on the flight, either the flight out there or the flight home, I had downloaded from the Criterion Channel. They did some sort of I think it was a 50s noir program in April.
Yes, there was one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so we I don't know, maybe it's just that the title stuck out, but I downloaded Born to Be Bad.
Oh, yes.
And we watched that, and I didn't know anything about it or who was in it. I think it was just that title stuck out to me from the list, and the synopsis was pretty fun as well. But we turned it on, And I believe I said this to you when I pitched this topic, but it's 100% true. Is we're on the airplane, you know, my girlfriend and I both huddled over the iPad with our headphones on, and you know, 15 minutes into the movie, Robert Ryan shows up, and I literally like closed my eyes and pumped my fist and went like, yes, like it's just I had kind of taken notice of him for the first time last year. When I went to the New Beverly Cinema, did a double feature. They were doing a month where they were playing a lot of Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte movies.
Yeah.
And it was a double of No Way Out, which is a Poitier thriller, where he plays like a young doctor who has to treat this really nasty racist bank robber or whatever, played by Richard Widmark, who plays a tremendous bigot.
Yes.
Truly plays a real awful creep. And then the second part of the bill was Odds Against Tomorrow, which we will talk about.
Yes.
Which is another movie about criminals, but in that one Robert Ryan plays this incredibly nasty character. So I remember walking away from that double being really taken with both of those movies, Odds Against Tomorrow in particular, but really Robert Ryan's performance. And then 6 or 8 months later, maybe Criterion again had a was it Criterion or was it we just wanted to watch? I think we just wanted to watch a snowy noir. You know, I have a particular affection. I love urban noir as well, yeah. But I love the kind of subset of noir that are the rural noir or the, you know, yeah, out in the snow, you know, winter noir. And I came across On Dangerous Ground.
I love that film. Yeah.
Not looking for a Robert Ryan movie, just looking for a snowy noir movie. Mm-hmm. And we watched that and I was like, oh, my God, I love this movie. And this performance is fantastic. And this is the same guy. So I was starting to put it together. Mm-hmm. And then this Born to Be Bad thing, again, I had such a visceral reaction to him showing up on screen, and that one's fun. I mean, we didn't make that part of our assignment because the movie's okay.
Yeah.
But he has a really fun part in it, and it's a different kind of part for him. He kind of plays this sarcastic, confident CAD writer character, which is not a common type of role for him. Across his career. But yeah, so because I had just seen that and just kind of really realized how much I loved whenever he showed up in a movie, I said, perfect. We'll see if Jen's into this. And then we'll have this excuse to watch, you know, 6 or 7 more Robert Ryan movies that I've never seen. So this is one where I'm kind of a neophyte also in this conversation. I was just like, I would love to have a reason to do this. I thought this was the perfect reason. And you were immediately enthusiastic about it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I love Robert Ryan. I think he is such a strong presence. The past several years, I got into the movie The Naked Spur, and then I went through a whole Anthony Mann Western thing. But I love Robert Ryan in that. And I had just seen him in noir. I remember Crossfire and the setup from like decades ago. I revisited both of those for this kind of on background because we were going to reference those. We kept wanting to like add other movies. And so while I was watching like all of these, like yesterday, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to rewatch The Professionals for the hell of it because it's so much fun. Did that because, you know, it's a blast. And you have Lee Marvin again. And yeah, it's just so good to see him in these films. I love that he is, you know, a tall, singular presence. He's 6'4", kind of imposing. I am someone who is tall, so I'm always curious in films when that happens because they kind of take the frame differently. And it's interesting to see how they use that physicality or don't with certain actors. I think he is also a fascinating person just on and off screen, how he is totally polar opposite. He was quiet. He was an activist. He was super professional. He was a veteran. He was in the Marines, and he also boxed in college for 4 years and, you know, had that kind of background and worked at a ranch and did all this, like, labor, but he loved to paint, and he was a big activist for all like First Amendment things. He became like a pacifist when he married a Quaker. He was just a really interesting guy. He's someone who we always saw playing such a monster and a bigot. And the film that kind of put him on the map was Crossfire, playing an anti-Semitic killer who, and he received an Oscar nomination, his only in his career.
Right.
And couldn't have been more different than that in real life. Yeah.
Well, it's, yeah, it's interesting. It's, you have this long tradition of oftentimes the people who are best at playing villains, at playing these nasty people, are then you hear about them and yes, they're everyone's like, oh, they're the sweetest person. You know,
yeah,
it's either something about, you know, in some sort of a therapeutic way, kind of using performance to excise those, you know, demons or those dark impulses so that they keep those things bottled up and it comes out in the work. Or some people are just good actors, you know,
yeah,
not that deep. Or, you know, when, especially in the case of Crossfire, this part, a lot of people didn't want to do it because this guy was so awful.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, in development at the same time as Gentleman's Agreement, these kind of first two movies to yes, tackle anti-Semitism in name, kind of head on.
Yeah, which was different Hollywood than the book. Yeah, because the book
is different than the book. Yeah, the book Crossfire, the book's not called Crossfire, but the no, book that Crossfire is based on is about it's not a Jewish man who gets murdered by this guy's army man, right? In the story. Mm-hmm. It's about a homosexual man getting killed.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, you know, the the censors were not going to allow that, obviously, in the 40s. But they, in fact, they insisted, even when they changed the character to being killed because of anti-Semitism, they, censors, but it wasn't still the Hayes office at that time. Was he still around? But it was whoever. The censors were like, make sure there isn't even like a hint of yes, heterosexual. They wanted, not even when it wasn't the main characteristic anymore, they're like, we don't even want this guy, you know, given us a sideways glance that can be misinterpreted. They wanted nothing, no hint of homosexuality in it at all. But even so,
they snuck some in a little bit, which I love.
I do think they snuck some in.
Yeah.
But
Edward Dimitrik, the director, acknowledges that. He said that.
Oh, did he? Okay.
His quote was, the Hays Code had a very good effect because it made us think. If we wanted to get something across that was censorable, we had to do it deviously. We had to be clever. And it usually turned out to be much better than if we had done it straight. And amazingly, yeah, I mean, Robert Ryan was like wanting this when it was a book, when they weren't even right, sure they were going to go that direction. He wanted to make this movie. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a couple of examples in the films that we're going to talk about where he had been previously familiar with the material in the literary form and then ended up playing in the movie. That was what happened with the setup and with this one with Crossfire. But yeah, his representatives told him it was kind of risky after the first like test screening or the screening for executives. One of the executives was like, oh, you're really gambling with your career. Like, it's a great performance, but you're, you know, gambling with your perception, you know, to the audience. But Robert Ryan had some quote where he said he really wanted to do this part because he knew this son of a bitch.
Yeah.
Like, this was a guy, this was a type of guy that he had encountered in his time at, was it Pendleton where he was?
Yes.
What's the one in San Diego? Pendleton, because he never actually shipped out.
No.
But he was at Pendleton for a few years during the war.
He even trained soldiers. Yeah.
Training soldiers. Yeah. So but he knew this guy, mm-hmm, and he wanted to, I think, make sure that this sort of person was portrayed in an honest way and a way that really got across to the audience that you know, this type of character can be rounded and can be complex, but he's a bad guy and he's not admirable and he's not to be sympathized with. And I think he kind of took on this clearly, I mean, he probably got typecast because he was so good at it, and he probably was out of his control to some extent what parts he got. But it seemed like he made it his mission to imbue these characters with humanity, like every good actor should, and make them compelling. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, not make them so fun or so likable that you start to excuse their actions.
So the authenticity was
fabulous there. At this type of role. Yeah.
Yeah. And this did, you know, kind of put him into the stratosphere for his career. And he played a bigot several other times in a couple of the films you're going to talk about. Should we just kind of slide into those and then backtrack? Do you want to do that?
Yeah, let's do it. However you would like to proceed.
I think chronologically, the next one is a classic that he is playing a bigot in. It's Bad Day at Black Rock, which is a masterpiece. It's kind of a neo-Western starring Spencer Tracy, just kind of a murderer's row of talent in this movie. If you have not seen Bad Day at Black Rock, you really should. This film also stars Walter Brennan, Ernest Borgnine, Lee Marvin. I watched an interesting interview this morning with Ernest Borgnine where he was talking about watching Robert Ryan and Spencer Tracy share scenes together. And in the film, Spencer Tracy arrives on a train and he has one arm. He has lost his arm in the war and he's looking for a Japanese individual and can't find them. Everyone is acting really suspicious. There's a big group of people. It's one of those films that uses open spaces and framing and blocking effectively the way people are positioned. It's kind of like an Edward Hopper painting come to life, essentially. The way it plays out, he doesn't know exactly what these people are hiding, but it comes out that they have, spoiler alert, killed this Japanese man. And Robert Ryan is the head bad guy. And when I watched the interview, Borgnine was talking about how in the scene where the two men, Spencer Tracy and Robert Ryan, are outside and talking, how Robert Ryan really fills the frame because of how tall he is. And Spencer Tracy is on a bench and he is angling his head downward and looking at the ground. And he just seems determined to do that. And at first, everyone on set is like, what is Spencer Tracy doing? He's just like talking to the ground. And he realized it was to pull focus. Like, you are just going to keep watching him. And so in the scene, it was almost frustrating. Like, Robert Ryan was trying all this different stuff. He like kneels down. He's trying to play off of him, make it a banter situation. But Tracy is just kind of eyes lowered. He knows what he's doing. Like, I know who this guy is and I'm not going to interact with him. And it makes it really electric. And so this is one of those films. It was in Library of Congress. It's been preserved. It's a classic. Had you seen this one before?
I had seen this previously. Yeah. I don't remember when. It might have been in school.
I was going to guess. Yeah.
Like, you know, 13, 14 years ago. But look, one thing I appreciated about most of these movies is that they are all a cool 90 minutes. This one, I think, is 81 or 82, maybe.
I know. It's short and, you know, they get in. There's not an ounce of fat.
On this entire thing. And one of the things that I love about it, I mean, the performances are terrific. I got Lee Marvin in this thing as well. Everybody in this movie is terrific. The setting is so unique. And what I love about it is it's 55, set about 10 years before that. And it is sort of this bright, sun-drenched neo-noir.
Yes.
But it's something you saw very, very infrequently, I think, is this type of story, this 80-minute contained, all takes place in one day, neo-noir. You got like eight characters and it is CinemaScope.
Mm-hmm.
It is ultra widescreen color CinemaScope.
Yeah. It's stunning.
These stunning vistas. It's I assume maybe New Mexico, Eastern California, somewhere in there. big time Asteroid City vibes on this movie. And in fact, actually, I think it was a direct influence on at least in terms of the setting on Asteroid City. And there was a book last year that Wes Anderson contributed to, this sort of companion piece to Asteroid City, that was a bunch of different essays and articles, like contemporaneous articles from like the 50s and things, but also essays about films set in the Southwest, all things that he kind of used as research or inspiration for Asteroid City. And I, if I'm remembering correctly, there's an essay about Bad Day at Black Rock in that book. So, but I just love, I love seeing this kind of story presented, as you're talking about, in this ultra wide frame where you can really luxuriate in these, this, the beautiful open location. And one thing that I think is cool about it, and you get this in a lot of Westerns also, but in a lot of noirs, in urban noir, you have this like claustrophobia, the sort of concrete jungle thing, and the looming buildings and the shadows and all this. And this is the polar opposite. This is a noir where you are trapped by expanse.
Yep. Nowhere to hide.
Nowhere to hide. It is, you know, 100 miles flat in every direction.
Yeah.
And you can see, and they really play into that, and how infrequently the train comes through.
Yes.
Becomes an important part of the plot, because once kind of the jig is up and Spencer Tracy knows these guys are low key plotting to knock him off, he has to wait another, you know, 8 hours before the train comes. So all of that, I think, is utilized really well. Like you said, the blocking, really taking advantage of every inch of the CinemaScope frame. There's some blockings where you've got 7-8 people all in a slightly different plane, spread out, all like, it's like you said, it's like a Hopper painting. Robert Ryan's great in this. He is so good at the casual villain, the guy who you're not quite sure how to pin him down. You know, is he charming? Is he maybe just a guy who, you know, made a mistake? And then by the end, slowly revealing that this is a truly rotten person to their core. And Spencer Tracy's performance in this also, like you're talking about, the whole movie, it's calibrated so well, and it's in the writing, but that he is just very polite and very professional and non-confrontational, and he is demurring constantly. And it is all just building audience anticipation for when he, at the very end of the movie, fights back. And you're like, oh,
Molotov cocktail time. Yeah,
exactly. So yeah. And builds to just a great confrontation at the end. And even I could have used a little more at the end. It kind of builds up, and then there's like a 2-minute scene and he kills Robert Ryan. It's done. You're like, oh, all right. You know, sometimes a tight 80 could use 2 or 3 more minutes of breathing room to let the audience kind of enjoy the moment. But no, I this one's great. And I think a really unique movie in terms of the style and the, but the blend of the style and the material is something we don't often see.
Yeah. And I loved what you were talking about, like a Southwest neo-Western thriller, because you can kind of see, and you can also imagine, like, if this was today, somebody like J.T. Walsh in the 90s doing this kind of role. Like, I was thinking about the movies Red Rock West and Breakdown, which are great Southwestern thrillers. And you could kind of imagine like a triple bill of all three of those movies playing. Kind of like
those. I just watched Red Rock West a couple weeks ago. I love that movie.
Yes. Yeah.
Breakdown as well. Kinda, Breakdown's great.
Yeah, where you're trapped. And what I love in Breakdown is at the beginning, I mean, he's just kind of a gentle guy and he's not sure where to turn. And can I trust this man? He's charming. But then, you know, then you start realizing he's not and dangerous, kind of like you said, with a casual villain. So you can imagine sort of a J.T. Walsh effect. So if you're a fan of those films, and J.T. Walsh, and you love 90s thrillers, you can maybe see, I can imagine the filmmakers, Masto and Dahl, watching this movie. I think this movie influenced so many, for sure. Yeah.
Oh, 100%. Yes. Yeah. This is one of those, maybe amongst all of the films, give or take a dirty dozen. I think Bad Day at Black Rock is sort of
super influential. Yeah.
Enjoyed the most kind of canonically embraced reputation,
yeah,
of this group, and maybe of most films Robert Ryan appeared in.
Yeah. Well, I like that you had discovered over at the New Beverly, our next one, Odds Against Tomorrow, which he plays another bigot in, because that's a film that I think is overlooked. Oh. And, you know, it was cut by Dee Dee Allen, you know, Mother Cutter, cut the Spielberg movies. It's really hip, Belafonte producing. A lot of, if you kind of look back at some of these films, a lot of these people were writers who were blacklisted, and the people working with them, and Belafonte, he tapped the writer he wanted to adapt Odds Against Tomorrow, and then finally in the 90s, the guy got the credit for it. It's a good film about a heist, a cop, ex-cop, deciding that we're going to knock over a bank, and he enlists the help of Robert Ryan, who is a bigot, and Belafonte, who is a gambler, and so, right, you know, like, that's not going to work. But these three,
I like that. That makes it sound like Robert Ryan's qualification to be in the bigot, to be in the heist, is, yes, all right, we need a bigot. We do.
Who do we cast? Tamar Widmark. No, yes. So he is, you know, he's a good criminal. Basically, he's been effective, and he knows how to work with cars and escape. And also, you just see the way he interacts with people in the beginning of the movie. It is eerie. It is like, I just brought up Widmark, but you can kind of see, like, had they not gotten Robert Ryan, they might have gotten Widmark, because there's a scene, sure, where he goes in the elevator, and the African-American elevator guy is like just talking, being amiable, and he's just kind of staring at him. And it's creepy, and the way he is with kids, and it's a, you know, it sets a mood. It has great jazz. Oh my goodness, if you love Belafonte, and who doesn't, you're gonna enjoy that. I think it's one that, you know, needs to have a new rediscovery. People need to watch this one.
This one, and it builds to this kind of shocking, abrupt, cynical. I mean, it's a, yes, very cynical movie.
Fatalistic noir.
Oh, yeah. My God. Bleak movie. I remember it was just a gut punch watching it, knowing nothing, yeah, about it at the New Beverly, and then watching it again the other day. I think, I want to say Kino, somebody recently did a Blu-ray restoration.
A few years ago, it was Olive Films, but I think someone else did after them.
Just, yeah, did one within the last like 6 months, maybe.
Yeah.
Or it's coming out. Or anyway, I'm absolutely going to pick it up, because this movie is, like we said, it's fatalistic. It's cynical. It's a gut punch. This is like a Live Wire movie.
Yeah.
And it's, and I think it's partially because it's sort of a different take on this character than Ryan generally does. Oh, is that the olive one right there in your,
yes,
hand? Oh
yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because here he is not the sort of charming villain who reveals himself as it goes along, or who, this guy is just a mean
mofo.
guy who hates everyone, including, yes, himself. And is just a truly unctuous character. And so from the beginning, this thing just feels like a tinderbox. You're just waiting to go off. But yeah, I love this one. This is another, it's got sort of a neo-noir feel to it a little bit. It's more of a crime movie than a noir, but I love this is, you know, 59. So we're, you know, however, less than 10 years out of the switch from the Academy ratio to a widescreen. And it's one of those on the cusp movies. It's kind of got a feels like a mid-40s sensibility, but it's late 50s. It's widescreen. It feels like it's got a little bit of a 60s sensibility. Yeah. It's they're using language you had not really heard that much before this point. Robert Ryan he's saying the N-word. Like, he is saying things that kind of are bracing. You're like, oh, this is, like, we're not tiptoeing around stuff anymore. We're not, you know, implying things. This guy is fully just a real nasty racist. But it's got, like you said, the jazz and the score, but it's got, you know, Harry Belafonte, who, of course, as a black man, is very rare up until today to see as a lead of this kind of movie. He's, like you said, he was, did you say he produced it? Or he was involved in development?
It was Harbel Presents. So Harry Belafonte's company. Yeah.
His company. So he, you know, produced this project. It's a great part for him. It seems like it's almost entirely on location, both in the city and then out for the third act, kind of out in upstate in the small town. So it's got this sort of independent, dangerous, outside of the system feel to it, but you've got a classic Hollywood actor, two classic Hollywood actors in it, in Ed Begley and Robert Ryan. And so I love these sort of transitional period feeling films where you get to have it gives you a little bit. If you love a great, you know, gritty 40s crime movie, it gives you a little bit of that. But if you want something that is feeling more progressive, more forward thinking, more independent feeling, you get a little bit of that too, which I love in this movie. But I think it's a great setup. And I think the structure is really interesting. It takes its time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost an hour before you get to kind of like the Dirty Dozen, where it's like
it builds. Yeah,
fully 2/3 of the movie are not what the movie is sold on. You know, the movie is sold on, it's this, you know, heist gone wrong and these guys with these different personalities butting up. But really, that's the last, you know, 25 minutes of the movie. They do such a, and Robert Wise, who is
brilliant. Yes.
Brilliant, and the king of making classic movies in every single different genre.
Yes.
And who himself started as an editor back on Orson Welles movies.
Yeah, he made The Setup with Robert Ryan.
The Setup. Yeah. We have to talk about The Setup a little bit. I love the structure where it takes its time introducing you to these people, introducing you to the problems. You fully understand why everybody ends up agreeing to do this job after rejecting the offer at first. Mm-hmm. Belafonte is a great complicated character. Robert Ryan, his scenes with Gloria Graham are so unnerving.
Yes, and Shelley Winters.
Weird and sad. Wow. Shelley Winters is great in this. But again, this is one of those guys. And he played a lot of characters who, if these movies were coming out now, the fucking Proud Boys would, you know, misappropriate them, be like, oh, I understand this guy. This guy represents me. But he plays these guys who feel that they have unfairly been sort of, passed by, and the world has moved on without them. And they have a lot of resentment and anger about this, which they feel is righteous. And this one, more than I think any other that we're going to talk about, really allows Ryan to chew into the darkness. And like I said, I think I said earlier, the rot at the core of this character, this kind of character.
All it's missing is a speech about wokeness, but it feels still timely. Yeah,
absolutely. And he's a pathetic. He's this pathetic figure who, I mean, is there any more dangerous combination than 6'4", you know, well-built, angry ex-con, pathetic, self-hating? this was never going to go well. And then the last act where they pull off, well, they, you know, do the bank robbery. Thrilling, well-staged shootout, pre-squibs.
So
but you get sort of like a proto-squib when Ed Begley gets gunned down.
Ooh, it is. Yeah, intense.
It's brutal. You don't get blood shooting out, but you sort of have this proto-squib that is a little like smoke hit, like popping off of his shoulders. So it's not the totally like
clean
bloodless,
shot.
Bullet-holeless, clean, you know, gun gunplay of yeah, the earlier
or red
era.
Paint. No, nothing like
yeah,
that.
No,
but feel it.
You
it's
feel
visceral.
It. You feel it viscerally. Yeah. And yeah, really tense. And then it culminates. I mean, what a message. And I think a metaphor on a couple of different levels, given the time period. You know, we're there in the Cold War. We're a couple of years away from Bay of Pigs. Mm-hmm. And Bay of Pigs and the missile crisis. And it's, you get Robert Ryan and Belafonte guns on each other on top of this, like these gasoline tankers or something.
Oh my God.
And the, you know, they know that if they shoot at each other, it's going to fucking one, yep. They're going to both die. And two, you know, it's going to be
like
this explosion.
Yeah.
But they fire, they kill each other. They set off these gas tanks. There's this fucking gigantic explosion. and then at the end, you know, you sneak in a little bit of a
social
message stinger, yeah. Which with the two corpses and the guy says, which one's which? And he says, take your pick.
Yeah.
So the metaphor of, you know, the nuclear standoff is there. The racial thing is there. Mm-hmm. The mutual assured destruction on multiple levels is represented there at the end of the movie. So I mean, God, I loved this the first time, and rewatching it, I'm even more
yep.
passionate in my feeling that I think this is, like you said, underseen, and I think a really good movie. I think this one's a classic.
I do too. And I think everything that you said was spot on. Also, just stylistically, the visuals, I mean, it's kind of like jazz, essentially, the way it's photographed and done. All the outdoor scenes in New York were really in New York. I have a quote from Robert Wise where he said, I did something in Odds Against Tomorrow I'd been wanting to do in some pictures, but hadn't had the chance. I wanted a certain kind of mood in some sequences, such as the opening when Robert Ryan is walking down West Side Street. I used infrared film. You have to be very careful with that because it turns green things white and you can't get too close on people's faces. It does distort them, but it gives that wonderful quality, black skies with white clouds, and it can change the feeling and look of the scenes. It was the last film that Wise shot black and white film in the standard aspect ratio to, quote, give his films the gritty realism they were known for. And after that, this movie came out, he shot two black and white films, both in CinemaScope aspect ratio, two for The Seesaw, which is very gritty, and The Haunting, of course, which is a classic. Yeah. Oof.
That's the Robert Wise's ability to be a stylistic chameleon.
Yes.
And adapt to the material and try something different for each project till he's had to try and achieve a different feeling.
Yeah.
Is really cool. I mean, the guy could do something these so gritty, and then also, like you said, The Haunting, which is this gothic and yes. just rich and carefully designed and all that. But then he's also doing Sound of Music, doing
I
West
know.
Side Story, Star Trek, the motion picture. I mean, it's a yeah. wild career.
Exactly. And he made The Setup, which we should probably backtrack and talk about our love of that film.
Oh,
without The Setup, you would not have Raging Bull. It
oh.
is, yeah. Film. I want to let you take it away on that because I know you particularly love
The Setup.
Movie.
Was my biggest discovery. I watched. I mean, I think we initially talked about doing five films.
Yeah.
I pitched because I started reading. I haven't finished it yet, but I started reading a Robert Ryan biography as I was kind of watching these movies.
Oh, I'm glad you did because I didn't have time to read one and I was curious. So you'll have to tell me if it's good.
Yeah, I didn't get through it. There's one from 97 and one from 2014. And I've been reading the one from 2014.
Okay.
Which is great. It's a great book. But you know, I got through those parts where they were talking about how important Crossfire and The Setup were
yeah.
to his career. And I was like, okay, I've got to do these. The
he
Setup,
especially proud of both. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And those are the two that he had kind of been following the material
yes.
Before they were developed as films. But The Setup is based on this narrative poem about a boxer who is, you know, is supposed to throw a fight and doesn't. And again, changed for the time and the censors, is the original poem is about a black boxer.
Yes.
But this is a poem that apparently Ryan at some point in college, like, recited for in front of a class or something. This was a piece that he really loved. And so the movie gets made. He's the star. It's Robert Wise. This is earlier. This is 10 years earlier, something like that. This is late 40s.
49. Early 50s. The other one was 59. Yep.
49. So 10 years earlier. And this is, again, just a fucking unfolds in real time.
Yes.
Absolutely.
72 minutes.
The tension is incredible.
Yes.
It's absolutely incredible. And it is so stylistically fun. Like, yes. Robert Wise is having a lot of fun with, there's the beginning part where it's not a one-er, and it's not even really trying to pretend to be a one-er, but he's doing this fun visual connective trick with the board, the program of the fights that's out in front of the box office. And he keeps following these conversations and then going back up to the names on the board and then pulling out of that and finding the next people who are conversing and then going back to the board and back to this. And really the whole thing takes place. It's in this boxing arena, but on this one block that they keep using, and they connect this to the hotel across the street where Robert Ryan's wife is.
Yep.
But yeah, the whole thing unfolds in real time. Like you said, 72 minutes. And it is about this over the hill boxer who, unbeknownst to him, is supposed to throw this fight. And his manager cuts the deal with this mobster that the fix is in. And they're like, he hasn't won a bout in.
He's going to lose.
In 5 months, he's going to lose anyway. Let's, you know, save him the humiliation of knowing he's supposed to throw the fight, and just he'll throw the fight. Circumstances conspire to inspire the boxer to overperform and not throw the fight. And he wins. Stoker wins. And then, of course, there are consequences for that. And it is, again, he doesn't die, does he? He gets the shit kicked out of him. And his wife is kind of like, oh, good. You're not going to box anymore.
Yes. She says, you won tonight. We both won tonight. Which is weird. Yes.
But this is, it's interesting. This is a similar type of guy to the villains that Robert Ryan played. Kind of a guy who's past his prime, who feels like he didn't get what he deserved in life, maybe. Mm-hmm. And is surrounded by younger people, by diverse people who are kind of taking what should have been his. But this is a guy who is not letting it turn him into a fucking nasty piece of shit. Like, this is a likable guy. He's a nice guy, and it makes it all the more suspenseful because you want him to do well.
Yeah. And you see, this is a job. Like, backstage, essentially, or back in the locker room, all the boxers sitting there. There's a new boxer who is getting increasingly terrified as they bring in a guy who's barely conscious. They have to bring him to the hospital. It is just, I mean, gory, brutal. It's in black and white. It's a B movie, but you feel it. Like, the sense of dread and, you know, the fear and just like, what are we doing to these people? They're putting their bodies, everything, their lives on the line for spectators and putting on a show, essentially. And so it gets into that mindset. And I think it's a good combo then of the idea of show business, or, you know, actors coming when they're not 100% or they're going through stuff, but you can't let anyone know. And then boxers, I mean, totally different thing, but similar enough. The old line, like, isn't every movie about movie making, kind of? So you can see right. that overlap. But also, this is a pet project that would have been close to Ryan because he did box for 4 years. So he knew what he was doing. And yeah, another gritty, authentic spin on his sort of tough guy character, but tough guy with a heart. Yes.
Tough guy with a heart. And again, this one is one that is such an interesting structure because the centerpiece, obviously, is this boxing match, which unfolds itself basically in real time. This is like it's got to be at least 20 minutes
yeah.
of this boxing match. And like you said, it's so clearly influential on Raging Bull. Like if you just imagine the fights in Raging Bull and put it in, you know, fucking yeah. 133, that's what yeah. this he is.
The crowd, it is
so contrasty, but yep. at the same time, you've got this pulsating audience surrounding and the smoke. And he shot it with a couple different cameras, and one of them is this like handheld, medium close, low shot that gets right in there with the boxers. Ryan trained, even though he'd boxed in college, he'd done a couple of movies that had to have more kind of like stagey boxing in them before this. And he trained to really box for real for this movie. And apparently real boxers told him that it was the most like visceral boxing they'd ever seen in a movie. And it looks rough. These guys are going at each other in a way that you just don't see this level of viscerality in a 40s movie generally. And this authenticity feeling. But so like that's the centerpiece, but this movie and it's, you know, obviously like the boxers aren't talking, it's wordless in that way. You get little cutaways to the crowd.
Yes.
And the different personalities in the crowd. But this movie is so full of colorful characters and personality. That sequence you were talking about in the I almost called it the dressing room as well, in the locker room. In the locker room is again, that's like a 20-minute sequence, and all it is character. Mm-hmm. It is establishing all of these different kinds of boxers who are boxing for different reasons, who come from different
backgrounds.
Different backgrounds, different social stratas, and they all have different stories. And you see how they all relate to Robert Ryan, how they all kind of inform his character, how he relates to them, or gives advice, or and that is so it's like that's very talky. You got this like great 20-30 minute talky sequence that is beautifully acted and blocked, full of character, and then you go into this brutal, wordless, very, very physical sequence. And through all of that, you've got this ticking time clock and this dramatic irony where the audience knows something very important that the lead character does not know. And you're just waiting for the other shoe to drop. And yeah, this one kind of stunned me. This one ended and I was like, oh my God, how have I not seen this before?
Yeah, like we were saying, this is one that would play really well with other boxing films, especially Raging Bull, but it would have influenced, I mean, you know, you can also see maybe like Rocco and His Brothers and just some of the films that would come after this, maybe took something from this. But thinking about another film that would go with it, 1 year later, over in England, Jules Dassin made Night in the City with Richard Widmark and Gene Tierney, and we're dealing with wrestling. And so we have another physical, a domineering person, and it's in a noir, totally different style of movie, but it also takes place in one night, if I'm remembering correctly.
Okay.
And so I think these two films together go together. The setup, it's kind of more crime than a true noir, essentially. Mm. But I think those two would be interesting to put.
Oh, cool. I've never seen Night in the City. That sounds great. Oh,
I think you'll like it. Yeah. But this is a person that he collaborated with, again, of course, because we just talked about Robert Wise. And we should probably go with, you mentioned Born to be Bad. Was that Nicholas Ray, right?
Yeah, Borny Bad is Nicholas Ray, someone he worked with a few times. That's also. This movie's okay. It's Joan Fontaine is the lead.
Yes.
And it's sort of like a scheming. It's not. It ended, and I was like, I don't know. This is a noir movie.
It's a little soapy. Yeah.
It's exactly. Yeah. It's kind of like a fun, soapy, schemey drama about this woman who's kind of trying to rise through the society ranks, and
one
really
dude at a time.
Yeah. One dude at a time, and you just never know what's really going on in her head. She's using people, but then acts like she's truly in love with Robert Ryan, but then it's confusing. Is she really just using him? And it's it's fun, it's salacious.
It's kind of Ryan Nick Ray really... in Cirque mode, essentially. Yeah.
Yes.
But not as good as Cirque. Yes.
No, not as good as Cirque. It's an okay movie, but I do think the best part was Robert Ryan, who's not in it enough for my liking, but he does. It's a different kind of guy for him. He's not using his physique in an imposing way. He's sort of this like lithe, cocky, charming, a little smarmy kind of, you know, intellectual who, maybe he's usually, a couple of highballs in.
He's
it's a fun
brain.
Character.
His brain more than brawn. Yeah. So, and I think it's cool that Nick Ray kind of used both sides of that because that's what he is in Born to Be Bad. And then you also have On Dangerous Ground, which I think it's such a beautiful, I think it was called like Snowy Noir, something like that was the collection that Criterion had. And there was another Robert Ryan in there, if I remember correctly, The Tall Men was also in there, which is kind of like a Western noir situation. But On Dangerous Ground is a beautiful, kind of another overlooked film. You have a score by Bernard Ehrman that's kind of almost like the score from North by Northwest a little bit.
Love this score.
Yeah, you run through the mountains and there's snow and he is playing just like I jokingly when I was describing the film, the angriest man in noir. He's a cop who's been burned out. I'm related to a bunch of cops who like left the force because, you know, you're there too long. You're seeing the worst in people and people are lying to you constantly and bad crime scenes. And so you do. It's like one of my relatives finally just said, I'm tired of being like angry all the time or not liking people. So he left. Basically, Robert Ryan's character has been a cop too long. He is burned out. He is angry. He's ready to just beat any suspect to the ground. Winds up going to the mountains because it's like, get the hell out of here, essentially, off the force. He's been around too long. He's bringing too much attention in a bad way and needs to get his priorities straight. So he has to help on a manhunt for a man who has killed a girl, who we find out is someone who has like kind of special needs a little bit, and the brother of Ida Lupino, who is playing a blind woman who kind of melts Robert Ryan's heart. It's not though as like treacly as that sounds. She is a real full dimensional character. I love this movie. Yeah.
I love it too. Another one that just watched cold, no pun intended, like, you know, whenever that was.
Cold and Western, yeah.
Cold,
noir.
And this is another one that's got an interesting structure because you remember the stuff in the mountain.
Yes. You forget about that whole beginning section.
He doesn't get up there till like halfway through the movie. Like it really is. Again, it takes its time.
Mm-hmm.
Really bring you into the world of this character. They want you to understand what drives this guy and why he does the things he does, and show, especially in this movie, establish an expectation for this character that then they can throw a complication at when he goes to a new place. He leaves his usual ecosystem. And you see how he behaves and you see how he reacts and you see how he has no mercy. and is just fully out of, you know, every criminal, like you said, he's losing it. This guy is cracking. The scene, and this is maybe the scene of his career that is going to always stick in my head. And the performance is, you know, they're the beginning, they're trying to track down these cop killers, and he's following up leads and talking to this kind of array of noir trope characters, the call girl and the whatever. And they track down this guy who knows where the cop killers are, and the partner leaves the room, gets the neighbors out into the hallway, and this guy's kind of being a wise ass. And Robert Ryan is just saying, like, you know, he's like, well, what are you going to do? Like beat it out of me or whatever. And Ryan is like, why he's got this fucking wild eyes. He's like, why do you make me do this? I know you're going to talk. I know you're going to talk. And he's like, why do you make me do this? Real like abuser. Why do you make me hit you? And then he starts like wailing at the camera as he, you know, the camera takes up the POV of the suspect, and Robert Ryan is just kind of coming down on top of it. Mm-hmm. And it's really upsetting.
Yeah.
So then, you know, then we throw him into this situation where somebody, Ida Lupino, kind of appeals to his higher nature, maybe his sense of forgiveness, forgiveness and of nuance.
Yeah. It starts with like, you know, don't let them kill my brother, like bring him in safely. Like she makes him promise, and that kind of reaches deep that, you know, people care about these people.
And he's paired up with another character who is a reflection of his dark sides, which is Ward Bond, who's the father of this girl who's been killed. And his whole thing is, I've got my shotgun. Yep. I'm going to hunt this guy down like a dog.
Yep.
No due process, no justice. Yep. If we catch him, I'm shooting him in the head with a shotgun.
Yeah.
And he is just driven by this singular revenge impulse, which then Robert Ryan has to work in contrast to. And I think, you know, it's this really well-told story of you create this rich, well-drawn character, and then you throw them into a situation where they have to reckon, you know, via interacting with characters who represent, you know, maybe two extremes, kind of reckon with themselves and maybe grow a little bit. But beyond that, just a thrilling movie. Love the location stuff. Colorado, I think, is where they shot this. The mountain stuff. Even though I think it's supposed to be upstate New York, I guess, is where it's set.
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Because they're in New York in the beginning. That's not like L.A. or something. That's New York, right?
I think
it is. But I believe they shot this in Colorado. I might be wrong. But you've got these beautiful mountains of snowy stuff. Or maybe they shot The Naked Spur in Colorado. They shot one of these movies in Colorado.
Oh, The Naked Spur was in the Rockies. Yes.
Okay. But I love the photography. And yeah, that score I just listened to on Spotify. That score.
Beautiful.
It's very North by Northwest. To me, it really felt like Elfman-y. Like Elfman took a lot.
Yeah.
It felt like Batman or something. Like, so it's got a big...
Well, he used it again, too, for Have Gun, Will Travel a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, he reused a sequence that became the opening theme for the TV show Have Gun, Will Travel.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, exactly. But it's great.
But yeah, the score, it's very... Well, I guess not... if it's Elfman, Batman-y, it's not modern anymore, but it's got sort of a kind of a, it doesn't feel like a 40s score. It feels ahead of its time.
Oh, yeah. I agree with you. Yeah. Yeah. It is such a good movie. And we're talking about noir in the mountains, and that leads us into the next one, which is The Naked Spur, Anthony Mann, shot in the Rockies. That's a neo-noir Western, essentially. It's in color. We get Robert Ryan in color. You get James Stewart playing a really dark character. You get Janet Leigh. I think I've talked about The Naked Spur on the show like maybe three times. I'm a huge fan. So people are probably tired of me talking about it. So I'll let you take it away. Was this your first time with this one? I can't remember.
Yeah, this was my first time seeing this.
Ooh, good.
I've only seen a couple of Anthony. Have you done an Anthony Mann Westerns?
No, I did an Pacific Anthony episode? Mann noir episode, okay. But not as Western. Man of the West is probably my favorite one he did. That was with Gary Cooper. It starts out kind of bright and it gets progressively darker until you're like, this is bleak as fuck. So Man of the West is, I think, the best one. And then I would put Naked Spur right below that. Yeah,
right below it. Well, I also say if you ever want to do, I'm gonna pitch a buddy for you. When we did on screen drafts in lockdown, so in 2020, we did this sprawling 3-part, broken up over the whole year, Western movie draft trilogy, and my buddy Darren Franich tried as hard as he could to get as many Anthony Mann Westerns on this. Possible. So if you ever want to talk Anthony Mann Westerns, I'll pitch Darren Franich. He would be fully in.
That's awesome. I'm going to have to look up those episodes that you did. Yeah.
Oh, it was fun. It was 3 parts, but it wasn't just all Westerns. We broke it up into, it was like classic Westerns, sort of like neo Westerns, and then modern Westerns. So it was,
okay, great.
And it was Darren Franich, formerly of EW, who's one of my oldest podcast friends. Is him and Billy Ray Bruton, and then they had a different third drafter for each part.
Okay.
We did one in the spring and one in the summer and one in the fall. And it was a lot of fun.
That's awesome.
Very contentious. And Darren kept I think he tried to play 6 or 7 Anthony Mann Westerns.
I would have a problem. I would keep throwing in Anthony Mann and Bud Butterker and like the people that don't get enough love. Yeah.
Absolutely. This is my first time with this one. And again, I love anything that stylistically feels a little bit unique, because you get these early 50s, because this one is in the Academy ratio, right? This is like 1:1:3:3.
I think so.
Or is it widescreen? Now I can't remember, but it's early Technicolor, which I love, and I love Technicolor on location.
1:3:3. Yep.
It is 1:3:3. So
yep.
Yeah, like, you know, you don't often get CinemaScope or like CinemaScope in, what was I saying? I don't remember what I was saying, but this is like it felt unique. You know, you get the Technicolor in nature there in that 1:3:3 ratio. So that's fun in and of itself. I love Jimmy Stewart. I'm glad, you know, I have not seen nearly as many Jimmy Stewart movies as I should have, or Janet Leigh. So to get all of them in this was really fun.
Yeah.
Ralph Meeker is fun in this as it took me like 10 minutes in. I was like, who? Where have I fucking seen this guy? And we just did, I don't know, 5 months ago on the Screen Drafts Patreon, my co-host Ryan Marker and I did a little mini draft of the 5 Mike Hammer movies. And of course, Ralph Meeker plays Mike Hammer in Kiss Me Deadly. Mm-hmm. So I was like, where have I? And then truly in the Dirty Dozen, like 20 minutes in, I was like, paused it and I was like, holy shit, this guy with the receding hairline is Ralph Meeker. He's really fun in this, kind of doing a Matt Damon in True Grit is kind of doing a Ralph Meeker.
I think so. Naked Spur thing. Yeah. A little bit of a ladies man, kind of a,
He's sort of the like add-on but to the like, group
creepy.
Who's all that thinks he's more charming than he is.
Exactly. Yeah. He's been dishonorably discharged.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This kind of rogue who's secretly being chased by the Native Americans. This is one that Robert Ryan is the villain, but another sort of different villain flavor. This one is a little bit of,
he's crafty.
If the Born to Be Bad character was a Western villain,
he's always, wheels are always turning.
He is crafty, he is sneaky, and he is never not grinning ear to ear, which is
that's a great
really
point,
unnerving.
Yeah, it is. It's so creepy. Yeah.
He's
it's just like Max Cady-ish, but like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but smarter. Yeah. But yeah, he's clearly having a blast. I think what's so great about this too, and that brings us into, I suggested Dirty Dozen, not even remembering that he doesn't have a big role in that movie. So we could kind of throw that in here too, but these movies, these men on a mission, big ensembles. Well, this is a smaller ensemble, but you know, you get to see different sides of these people and to see all these men interact. But what I love about this one is Dirty Dozen is a long film, of course. This right. is a shorter film. Within the first like 5 or 10 movies, I mean, we're in a shootout. You've got people just assuming that Jimmy Stewart is a cop. He's a bounty right. hunter. Well, back then they called him bounty killers, actually, because dead or alive, he's going to sell the body if he can and get the money. And so he hires this other man for like $20. Help me get this guy, Robert Ryan. And then they come across another person and there's rock slide. So you have like a big action setup. You are thrown in it. It's kind of modern in that way. Like usually yeah. some of these Westerns, it takes a little bit of time. They establish the setting and takes a little bit to get going. Naked Spur. No, I mean, a few minutes you're on the trail. You're ready. Yeah.
You're ready. And it's interesting. I've been praising these other movies that take their time to really set up these characters. And
for sure.
So the audience knows them and the audience can develop these expectations. And then you get kind of the narrative intrigue from that and seeing how these characters are going to behave given this new set of circumstances. This is a different kind of story that is equally as fun, which is everyone's a mystery. And you learn alongside the other characters. You're kind of plopped in the middle of it and you learn who everybody is and what their true intentions are and what their backstories are alongside the other characters in the movie. So I think that's really fun about this one. And certainly the revealing of what Jimmy Stewart is driven by and the true nature of the relationship with Janet Leigh and Robert Ryan, the reveal of what's really going on with Ralph Meeker. There isn't really a big reveal with the gold prospector, Millard Mitchell, who's also a lot of fun in this movie. I love the rock slide shootout at the beginning where Robert Ryan apparently has found just an endless supply of small boulders that he can roll down a hill.
Yes, exactly.
Jimmy Stewart. But no, it's great, if you've seen the Coen's True Grit, it unfolds a little structurally a little like that. You get these different people, like he captures Robert Ryan and Janet Leigh very quickly, and then it is about this little band of people getting across the Rockies into town where he can hand him in to be hanged.
And they get increasingly complex as you go, because at first you just think one thing about each character, and like you were saying, they dole out little truths here and there, and who's working who, and the Janet Leigh character I thought was really interesting. Usually in Westerns of this time period, the women didn't have quite as much to do, or they were more one-dimensional. They were, you know, oh, don't get hurt when you go kill the guy, essentially.
Right.
But in this one, she's a woman who her dad was gunned down. He was like robbing a bank. He was the partner of the Robert Ryan character. So now she's just kind of had no one to take care of her, is with him, essentially.
Right. She's got
else to go.
And then at the end of the movie, she ends up with Jimmy Stewart. So she's got daddy issues.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's a really, really fun, really satisfying Western. You get thrills, you get drama. There's a nice touching ending with a little bit of hope. So some good shootouts. Yeah, I really enjoyed this one.
Great. And then, like I said, I did mention the Dirty Dozen, not remembering it's a fun role for Robert Ryan, essentially seeing him interact with Lee Marvin, and they like can't stand each other and seeing them kind of one up each other. But it's a men on a mission movie. I love that film. I am a big fan of the World War II epics, dudes going in there. I got hooked on a movie last year called Where Eagles Dare. I had not seen this film.
I've got to
That
see that.
became like a new favorite with Richard Burton and Clint Eastwood. It's a blast. And it's kind of that kind of thing. So, The Great Escape, you have Dirty Dozen. These are great movies. But yeah, Robert Ryan. He's not doing a lot in this one, but it's a vital supporting role, but it's not one of his best.
But I'm still glad that this ended up on the watch list because
Good.
I hadn't seen this before.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, this was,
Okay, now I'm glad.
yeah, the
So you
Dirty
were
Dozen
probably
was
like,
one of
what is
those.
she?
I know the Dirty Dozen. No, yeah, I mean, if I had known that his part was smaller, I may have been like, oh, let's do something else. But I'm glad that I watched this because this was one of the biggest I hadn't seen movies, probably
And the
remaining
cast is
for me.
incredible.
If the cast is incredible. I also love the World War II Men on a Mission movies, and this is, of course, probably the one of the best now that I've seen it. Yeah, but Robert Ryan has a small-ish role, but there's so many people in this movie that hardly anybody
Oh my
has
God, I know.
a big role. I'd say the biggest roles, I guess, are Lee Marvin and Cassavetes.
And Charles Bronson maybe, but
He's basically the villain of the movie because
but yeah.
the Nazis are the villains, but we don't, again, this is one where this is an hour and 45 minutes of learning
Set
about
up.
these characters and
Building the team.
becoming the team and really making the audience love these guys. And then the last 45 minutes is this great action suspense piece where they attack the. Oh yeah, Bronson's also a kind of a bigger part, kind of pops in this movie. But I'd never seen it and I loved it. It was so fun.
Oh,
It's
good.
just it's really funny and it's really interesting to watch the training kind of process like that and the politics, the inter-military like bitching and how they all hate each other and they all have agendas and they're all worried about who's in the
Ranks and
hierarchy and
orders and
yeah and Robert Ryan fucking hates Lee Marvin's guts and so he's basically I mean kind of the there's sort of two narrative climaxes to this movie. One of them is when they win the war games and they fucking show up Robert Ryan and you get that triumphant moment. That feels sort of like the climax of the training movie. That's the they finally work together as a team and they beat the mean principal
I
in
love
Robert
that
Ryan.
scene with Donald Sutherland, who was a
Oh yeah.
newcomer, where they have him pretend to be a general, or is it a major? I can't remember which, but yes.
Yeah, general. No, that's and one thing I thought watching this movie was this is another one that feels like it's on the cusp. Like there's a real earlier 60s gung-ho World War II American exceptionalism strain to it. There's a Guns and Navarone strain to it. Like you said, those Clint Eastwood movies, those John Wayne movies. There's that to it. But I feel like it's sort of half and half. We're on the road to MASH with this movie. There is a
Tides are changing.
the tides are changing. There's an irreverence here. There is sort of a critical nature running through it of the military. There is, Cassavetes is
Death
basically a
penalty.
McMurphy predecessor in this thing. And you've got Jim Brown in here. There's some diversity. We're talking about racial issues. We're talking about mental health in the military. And Donald Sutherland being there, it feels very much, yeah, we're kind of moving into the more critical and cynical view of the military that we get really heavily in the
70s. Yeah, we're starting to question authority in Dirty Dozen in a really interesting way, I think. Yeah, and I love that, again, it partners him up with Lee Marvin. I rewatched yesterday The Professionals, which is a film that was written and directed really brilliantly by Richard Brooks, who goes way back with Robert Ryan to training at Pendleton, I believe, is where he first met him. And he was a writer, of course. And that's a Western. You have Lee Marvin. But what's great about that is Robert Ryan is one of the good guys in that movie. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene where a character shoots a horse in order to, like, we don't have enough food, or let's stop it from following us, that kind of thing. And some of the decisions that get made, you suddenly see like a quieter or more pensive or a different side of Robert Ryan than we're used to seeing in some of these other movies. But it's funny. You have just a great cast. Like, there's twists. It's a fun movie. So if you haven't seen The Professionals, if you're listening to this, check it out. If you're a fan of terriers, there's a little Easter egg there. Ted Griffin took the name Dolworth from the main character played by Burt Lancaster and gave it to his lead in Terriers. Yeah.
Yeah. The Professionals is one I've always wanted to see and didn't have time to. There were
so many we could have done. Yeah.
As I was watching these and reading the book, I kept adding. I was like, oh, do I have time to fit in Act of Violence? Do I have time to fit in?
You know, that was killing me. I remember liking that film, but you can't find it anywhere. It's a bummer.
You can't find it. They have it. It's not going to do you any good. They have it at Vidiot's here in LA.
It will. I'm going to be there.
You're going to be in town.
Yeah.
So get Act of Violence. I, you know, also got a rip of it, so.
Okay.
I can also just email it to you. Act of Violence and Inferno was one that I was interested in watching and didn't get to. Another one that's hard to find. The Professionals. And even, you know, in doing the Robert Ryan research, apparently his performance in The Iceman Cometh.
I did see that years ago.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was desperately wanted to fit that in, but that is literally 4 hours long. So I did not have time to fit that in for this. But yeah, I mean, it's all the way, you know, he doesn't start acting until his late 20s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's told that he's not good enough for several years. And then he has this sort of natural magnetism and this real authenticity that pops on the screen. And he puts this career together, always playing these interesting characters, taking roles that are maybe thankless or are cliche or are things he's typecast in, and always even giving those something interesting. But he's got, I mean, we just talked about these movies. He's got this fascinating career and he keeps going. He gets cancer and he passes in his late 50s?
Yeah, he passed in 73 right after his wife had passed too.
73, yeah. So he's in his like late 60s or something. And he acts all the way right up to the end. You know, he does Iceman Cometh, and he does Long Day's Journey Into Night, I think. But he does these like doing this challenging material and these interesting characters all the way to the end. So, and on top of it, you know, founding schools and, like you said, being involved in the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. and really after, according to the biography, after at least one on screen or on set dalliance early in his career, really committing himself to his family and being a dad and being a husband, which is, as you said, was a real outlier.
And
he kind of lamented maybe cost him some more interesting and maybe more diverse work because he wasn't hobnobbing and he wasn't rubbing shoulders.
Yeah.
But in the end, I mean, I'm going to continue probably on this project because it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. And like I said, another one that I think I just watched for the first time last year was The Tall Men, Which is another Western. I mean, there are so many. I know he was in The Longest Day. Neither one of us are huge Wild Bunch people. I mean, it's, you know,
I don't know.
I haven't seen it since college. I remember it being like powerful, but yeah, I haven't. I should revisit it, I think.
I mean, it's interesting because so I watched it. That was one of the first things they showed at the Egyptian Theater when it reopened here.
Okay.
In Hollywood. So I saw it on I think it was a 70 millimeter print.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie I don't love. I think it's too long.
Yeah.
I think the character work is a little shallow. It's really it's a men on a mission, you know, it's this group of guys doing a thing. But I think it is relying really heavily on a really sour machismo that is, it's a thing where if you look at it academically, you're like, okay, this is an interesting commentary on or et cetera, et cetera. But when you're watching it, you're just kind of like, I'm not having fun watching this. This is just kind of, there's no even really fun character in the whole thing. Everybody's just kind of gross, but they cast Robert Ryan as this sort of ineffectual, like it's interesting to look at. It's sort of a subversion of his usual character because he's not in this movie the scary one or the tough one or the dangerous one. He's like the ex-partner who has become a lawman. He's become a marshal, and he's kind of wimpy and wishy-washy and not, you know, he's kind of like, oh, they got away again. It's, you know, it's like, it's interesting because it's different, but it's not a great part. I don't know. We're probably both gonna get in trouble for
I know we're gonna be like,
okay, you shit on the Wild Bunch.
No, but he actually did not enjoy making the film. He and Peckinpah famously butted heads. He said something like, you tell me what to do on the set, I'm gonna do it, but if you say a word to me off the set, I'll knock your teeth in. Which, you know, I think he wanted some time off to do some campaigning and some work for the Democratic, I think it was McCarthy, the presidential you know, race that year, and to do some political stuff, and I think there was some family stuff. So I know it wasn't one of his favorites, but I think we did cover a lot of his favorites and some great movies, I think, that are less famous than The Wild Bunch that should be sought out. Like, you know, look up On Dangerous Ground, The Setup, some of these that have been forgotten, Odds Against Tomorrow. And I think, you know, it's good. These are films that he was really proud of. And, you know, they just don't make him like Robert Ryan. Yeah.
They just don't make him like Robert Ryan, you know. One of those guys, I mean, the last of his kind, or someone like, I don't know, like Hackman, or you know, these people who sort of, they were
like a David Morse or a, you know,
they've got this presence and they've got this honesty to them, and they've got this world weariness that, you know, unfortunately a lot of them got this from having to be in the military often against their will. I know Robert Ryan was kind of happy to finally get drafted. He was sort of frustrated that Hollywood was sort of giving him this excuse. They kept, once he got drafted, the studio kept deferring.
Oh, interesting.
Him for picture after picture after picture. And he was starting to get kind of self-conscious that he had not gotten in uniform yet. You know, but yeah, they get it from the military. I mean, and like you said, he, in his 20s, he was a ranch hand and he was a merchant marine. And he was like, it was these people who lived these lives before they got into acting and were able to imbue their characters with this experience. And
and someone who went to Dartmouth, went to college.
And he was an intellectual as well.
So
really interesting. I recommend the biography. Like I said, I'm only like halfway through it, but it's called The Many Lives of Robert Ryan, maybe. Okay. But it's really well written, and it's also just got great, you know, mid-century Hollywood anecdotes and things in it. So that's fun. But there's a crazy story in the beginning of the book
The Lives of Robert Ryan by J.R. Jones. Good read. But there's this a crazy story at the beginning about he grew up in Chicago to a family in a upper middle class family that had a construction business. And there's this crazy story about this tunnel project that they were doing that went horribly wrong. And there was an accident and this insane fire that went on for days and meant multiple people died in it. The whole city of Chicago was wrapped up in it. And so anyway, there's a very interesting story at the beginning of that book that has nothing to do with that's when he was away at college. But anyway,
but it still shapes.
Yeah. He was a dyed in the wool Chicago Democrat.
Yeah.
And that, that informed the rest of his life.
Yeah. Midwesterners. That's what we're talking about. Well, Clay, I want to thank you so much for doing this, for being here, for giving me excuse to rewatch a bunch of great movies.
Oh, my God. No, this is great. This is great. I'm so glad that you were excited about this idea because they're all fun and he's good in all of them. But there are a few, like you said, like the setup, Odds Against Tomorrow, On Dangerous Ground, that really feel like forgotten should be classics.
Yeah, even The Naked Spur. More people need to see
The Naked Spur, even Crossfire. We didn't talk about Crossfire as in depth as some of the other ones, but he is captivating in that movie.
Yes, it's an early performance. It's the one that got nominated, and it's so powerful.
He blows Mitchum off the screen. Now, Mitchum...
It's the three Roberts. You have Robert Young, Robert Mitchum, and Robert Ryan.
And Robert Ryan, yeah, and... By all accounts, Mitchum was not really given that one his all, but the guy who plays the cop is really good in Crossfire. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Really interesting performance. Anyway, they're all great. I loved them.
Yes. Seek them out. All right. I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.